I was actually overseas during 9/11. Even in an overseas post, there was a realization that the world had really changed. Our world had changed, and everything was now focused on what we called at the time the war on terror.
September 11th changed America, and the attacks also changed the Central Intelligence Agency.
I remember coming back to Washington maybe 3 or 4 weeks after 9/11, coming in and going into the offices of CTC, the Counterterrorism Center at CIA, and there were cots set up in the hallways. People had just, when 9/11 happened, come to the offices of the Counterterrorism Center, volunteered, rolled up their sleeves and said, "How can I help?" And there were people sleeping there in cots because they didn't want to go home.
We've heard this before, right? Agencies like the CIA wanted to be in the fight against terror, and they got in, upending the next decade and a half of U.S. policy on surveillance, immigration, and what it means to wage
our war on terror.
That war definitively included torture.
Did you authorize the tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program.
No, the use of torture compromises that which most distinguishes us from our enemies.
I believe that waterboarding was torture.
It worked now for 13 years. Mm-hmm. We've avoided another mass casualty attack.
History will judge us.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong.
Gina Haspel is part of that history. Her story is where we begin today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. The CIA strategy after 9/11 changed the career trajectory of Gina Haspel, who today sits before the Senate Intelligence Committee in a push for her to be the next head of the nation's top spy agency. Some senators today will question Haspel's operations of a secret black site prison in Thailand back in 2002. While she was there, officers waterboarded one al-Qaeda suspect, a practice that was considered at the time an enhanced interrogation technique. Another suspect was waterboarded prior to her arrival on the site, and 3 years later, Haspel was involved in the destruction of evidence of these kinds of interrogations. But colleagues of Haspel say that her 33-year career at the agency extends far beyond the period that she spent in that compound, which was codenamed Cat's Eye.
I heard of Gina before I actually met her, and I must have heard her sometime in the early 90s, heard about her.
Carol Raleigh Flynn is a former CIA officer who served the agency from 1982 to 2011. You heard her earlier describing the shift in the CIA after 9/11.
I first actually met her. I was serving as a chief of station overseas, and I came back to Washington to have some consultations. And I met with Gina at the time, and that's the first time I came across her.
And what was her reputation at the agency then, and how has it evolved over the years?
At that point, I didn't know much about her. I had heard that she was a promising young officer, that she had been out in the field. By that we mean overseas, worked overseas as a case officer or an operations officer, terms we use interchangeably. So I didn't really know that much about her at that point.
And today you would say her reputation is, how would you describe it?
Stellar. Very highly thought of inside the organization. I was at a recent conference where there were a lot of CIA officers in attendance, and one of the speakers mentioned her name and her nomination, and there was spontaneous applause and cheers for Gina. Very, very well thought of.
I want to take us back a little bit to, I think, one of the most fundamental political shifts we've had in the United States, which was obviously 9/11. Did that shift also include what some would call torture, others would call enhanced interrogation techniques?
You know, it's interesting you ask that question. In the days immediately after 9/11, I was not aware of that program. That was a very sensitive program that was very much compartmented, and I didn't know anything about it at the time. I think most of the folks in the CIA knew nothing of that program.
But it was a real program, and it was happening at that time, correct?
I can't actually tell you. I don't know exactly when that program started, but it did start in the days after 9/11.
So maybe you can help us understand, because we talk a lot about, like I said, torture versus enhanced interrogation techniques. Is there a difference between the two?
Well, to be perfectly candid, I'm not an attorney, and my understanding is that torture has legal definitions. And we had two sets of lawyers, one during the W. Bush administration and another set of attorneys in the Justice Department during the Obama administration, and they had differing views on how to define torture.
What are some of the, I mean, you mentioned you're not an attorney, but aren't there limits and laws to how much these techniques can be used, specifically waterboarding, which is one of the techniques that Haspel apparently oversaw?
Tanzina, I can't comment on that because I simply don't know. I'm not an attorney, and I'm really not familiar with the precise definitions.
Do you have any sense of why Haspel was put on the site in Thailand?
No.
Okay. Do you think that she's being treated fairly in terms of the criticism for her involvement in that situation? Or there is another camp that says she was essentially following orders and did what she had to do?
In terms of fairly, I don't think fair is the right question to ask. I think we're a democracy, and I think open debate is very critical to a healthy democracy. You know, I think anything's fair game when you have a nominee for a position. I will say at the time she was a mid-level civil servant who was carrying out a lawful program that had been approved by the Department of Justice. I won't defend the program, but I will stress that it was a lawful program at the time. I would also say that the senators who are going to be voting on her nomination, many of them were briefed on this program and posed no objections to the program in the wake of 9/11. It was a time of national emergency.
Of course. And interestingly, last week, Haspel attempted to withdraw her nomination because she was concerned about whether or not this process would impact the CIA negatively or impact her negatively. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do have some thoughts on that. Again, I can't attest to the veracity of those stories that she offered to withdraw her name. However, she is a very, very conscientious person who I am certain would never want to do anything to harm the CIA or our country. And if she felt that her nomination were going to be a distraction or harm the mission of the CIA, it would be very much like her to offer to withdraw.
What are some of the legitimate concerns that senators have a right to ask about and that the American public has a right to know about, understanding that there are obviously national security concerns here?
Mm-hmm. I think oversight, congressional oversight, both in the Senate and the House, is a critical part of our democracy. When you have an organization such as the CIA that conducts its business secretly, I think it's absolutely vital that there be a very robust oversight mechanism. And that is our Congress. And I think it's very important for those in the Congress who have oversight responsibilities to be privy to the goings-on at the CIA and to be privy to information about Gina Haspel.
Raleigh Flynn is a former senior CIA officer who served the agency from 1982 to 2011, and she's currently the CEO of Singa Consulting. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Turns out that Americans are pretty evenly split on how they feel about the issue of torture. Recent data from Pew found that in a survey of more than 4,000 American adults, 48% said there were some circumstances in which torture is acceptable as part of anti-terrorism efforts, and 49% found no circumstances in which it's acceptable. Let's make sure we understood that. Slower now, almost 50% of the survey is all right with some torture. Karen Greenberg is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. Karen, so glad you're here with us today to help us make sense of what's happening. I saw lots of head shaking in our as we were listening to this previous conversation with Raleigh Flynn. Have Americans always been this evenly split on how they feel about torture?
Yes. One of the things that has been so frustrating and disappointing in trying to alert Americans to the problem of making torture lawful and making it state policy is the degree to which people have their opinions ahead of time, and it's such a partisan issue, it's hard to reason your way through it. So in many ways, I feel like those of us who have tried to lay out the opposition to torture have failed over the past 16 plus years. And so it's not a surprising statistic. It's an extremely, from my point of view, disappointing statistic.
Now, we heard in the interview with Raleigh earlier, there was some sort of inability to answer the question, where does torture, how do we define torture versus an enhanced interrogation technique? What would you say to that?
So let me just step back a little bit and say that I think a lot of what she said was actually excellent and very much along the lines of how I would have answered many of the same questions, both about Gina Haspel and about how to think about this program generally. So particularly when it comes to the issue of oversight, that one of the things that's very clear is that whether or not individual senators were briefed on this, which they were, there is no formal and strong and, in her words, robust congressional oversight, and there has been no judicial oversight of the torture program. And I think the other two branches of government need to be empowered to do this. In terms of what was lawful and what was unlawful, it's so interesting to note how the CIA and its spokespersons keep batting the ball to the Department of Justice. And actually, this goes back to the very inception of the program, where lawyers at the CIA went to the Department of Justice and said, "Not us. You say this is okay." I've often wondered if they actually expected a no.
I'm still waiting for the clear definition of these two things.
So, it's not a clear definition of torture. It's a clear definition of whether it was made lawful. It was secretly made, quote unquote, lawful by lawyers inside the Justice Department who basically said, given the array of what was going on, given the war on terror and the threat, and given the commander-in-chief powers, which are supreme, therefore they could do torture for this end. And what it tried to do was back away from accountability for it should it come. So let's posit this another way. If you believe that the United States is a country that can rely on secret laws that nobody knows about that are justified outside of legislation, outside of Congress, and outside of any judicial authority or process, then in some circumstances, some people would say this was lawful. For those people who have read the Constitution, understand the balance of powers, understand the role of Congress and the judiciary, it is very dissatisfying and undermining to hear this referred to as lawful. What they really mean is this is something the president said was lawful, and the president said they can do. Given the fact that we have a president now who has pushed against the edges of the law rhetorically in many different ways, do we really want to be thinking about how laws can be made secretly, commands can be given secretly, which change fundamental laws, which go against the Uniform Code of Military Justice, international law, statutory law, and constitutional law, which is what saying that torture is lawful is. If we're going to go down that route, let's put it before Congress. Let's talk about it in that way. Because do we really want to be a country that establishes law torture as lawful at the highest levels? And if we do, then this is a national debate we could have. I think there can be some very interesting ways to do that. But secret law, I don't think we're a country that thinks of itself as operating under secret law, which is what the torture was.
And when we say torture, just so we're clear, these are also considered enhanced interrogation techniques. Are we talking specifically about something called waterboarding or—
Okay. So there were a series of techniques that were approved by these memos at the Department of Justice, not once, but several times in several iterations. And that included a number of techniques, which are now coming to the fore. Some of them was smashing somebody's head into a wall called walling, other kinds of stress positions, slapping, what was the right way to slap for it to be lawful or unlawful. And so it's bending the rules as much as they can. And waterboarding is, of course, one of the techniques they used. The reason for using enhanced interrogation techniques is because torture is not legal. And so it was a way of skewing the conversation so that they could back away from it. So that's what's at issue here. And what's really interesting about the Haspel nomination, which is why we're having this, is that think about it this way. This individual who has been put forward for the director of the CIA now is bearing the brunt of the fact that this country has not had the conversation it's needed to have about torture. We've pushed it under the rug. Every time somebody else has come up for nomination for a different kind of post and has gotten the post, and torture's come up in the background or some of the media has raised it, it's gone away. And
why do you think that is? Why the hesitation? Why do we not stay on it? Why aren't we answering the questions you think we should
because
be answering?
Because it's a really hard conversation. This is not For a lot of people, it's black and white, but it's actually a gray area. As Raleigh Flynn said, look, it was after 9/11. There were a lot of stresses on the country. This was the direction we chose to go. The reason to have this is in case this happens again. This is not the way to go. The 6,000-page torture investigation and report that Dianne Feinstein's committee produced basically said it didn't work. Whether or not it worked or not, we know it undermines basic principles about our country. Once you open that door, who knows what other doors of unlawfulness at the hands of the executive can take place. We need to have this discussion. And the reason we haven't had it is that there's concerted effort to protect officials and others who made this happen. And why? Because it's unlawful, because they could be punished, because they could, you know, be imprisoned. And so there's been a sense of stepping away from it and wanting to protect them under the guise of national security. My answer to that is this. If you feel that you had to torture individuals because it was important for the security of the country, then let's have a hearing on it. Just like the individual who shoots their spouse in self-defense because they're being beaten. There is a defense, but let's hear it, let's adjudicate it, let's consider it. But this idea that it happened, we're never going to deal with it, and leaving it open for the future under a president who has said that waterboarding wasn't enough is extremely dangerous. And it is Gina Haspel that it's falling on because we've refused to have it come down on anyone else's shoulders.
One of the narratives that's come out about Gina Haspel is that she was following orders, you know, when she stepped into the role that she stepped into. Is that an acceptable sort of explanation for what happened? Don't we all sort of follow orders when we're...
Not everybody follows orders. Okay. And there were a number of people who mm-hmm. lost their jobs because they didn't follow orders about torture, you know? And we've seen that time and time again. There were a number of people who stepped away from it. There were a number of people pushed back against it. There weren't enough people who had objections secretly or privately and were willing to make it public. Nobody was willing to take that stand. You know, the idea of following orders when you have a president who may give such orders again is really not useful in any way. But, you know, it doesn't seem to me a narrative that has a lot of traction.
Now, what about does this ultimately impact everyday Americans? Like, if the United States continues to use these sorts of, quote unquote, enhanced interrogation techniques or torture, can it and does it and will it affect us on
the
ground?
Americans think it doesn't, and that's why you have the Pew poll. But it's a long, slow slide. And if you start with torture and you think it's just against the other and those who are foreign and those who are enemies, let's see how we define enemies. It's a very important bottom line to everything that's fundamental about American jurisprudence and civil liberties.
If you're just tuning in, we'd love to hear your thoughts on whether you support the use of torture or not. Americans are pretty divided on this. I want to thank our guest, Karen Greenberg, the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. Thank you for being with us to talk about this very complicated issue.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Jim, and I'm calling from Atlantic City, New Jersey. Listening to the takeaway in regards to torture and waterboarding, you know, following orders is not an excuse for torturing anyone, as it is illegal, as was pointed out in the show. Thank you.
This is Matt from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I completely agree with your guests right now. Torture is wrong. We're better than that.
Thanks, everyone, for being with me for day three here on the New Takeaway Podcast. There's plenty more to come, including the impact of President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Iran deal on the Americans who are currently being imprisoned in Iran.
When the Iranian-American now in prison will learn what has happened, they will feel their chances for release has really greatly diminished.
And next, our continuing look at identity in America. This time, it's all about the rich folks. Right after this on The Takeaway.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to The Takeaway. We say it a lot, but we really mean it. Our listeners are the most important part of our show. Think about it. If a podcast plays in the forest and nobody's around to listen to it, does it even make a sound? That's deep, right?
Whoa.
We want to hear from you. Jump into the discussion on our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. We retweet and keep listening. Thanks again.
We're talking about identity all this week on The Takeaway. On Tuesday, we looked at the working class. Today, we turn to the elite, the 1% who literally have so much money that, as our next guest says, they're now after what's being called a four-pack of houses, i.e. homes in New York City, the Hamptons, Miami, and Aspen. The media, politicians, pundits, they love to hate the elite. But who makes up this group, and why all the hate? Anand Giridharadas is the author of the forthcoming book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World.
Since 1979, half of Americans, the bottom half, 117 million people, have gone from an average income of $16,000 to $16,200.
So that's not much of a raise, is it?
That's about 39 years. We've invented the internet in that period. We've had globalization happen in an extraordinary way in that period. Any number of things have happened that are amazing. And here's what was happening to incomes at the top. If you were in the top 1%, your income today is triple what a 1%er earned in 1979. And if you're in the 0.01%, you actually earn seven times more than what someone in the 0.01% earned in 1979. And what that tells you is the resources that are not going to the bottom half of Americans are going somewhere else. They are going to other people. They are buying those four packs of houses as many Americans struggle to make a living. And of course, we know this in all these anecdotal ways. We know that workers at Walmart are also on food stamps. We know that hunger is just alarmingly high in New York City, given what New York City looks like and the fact that it's the greatest concentration of wealth and power in the history of human civilization.
But if I'm sitting in one of my four-pack houses and I make, you know, I have a net worth of $8 million, I mean, what does it really matter? Why do I really care about that Walmart worker?
You probably don't. And I'm here to try to make people understand that they are not living in the paradise they think they are. The paradise they're living in has a basement, and the basement contains multitudes of people who are locked there so that you can be above it.
So help me understand how a president, as we have our current president, is part of this elite. How was this president able to run on a populist message, if you will, whether it was accurate or not accurate, and rally this sort of white working class, you know, base, or at least that was the perception of who he was able to rally, when, as you said, half of the country hasn't had a raise in quite some time?
One of the most interesting things about Donald Trump is that he is at once an exploiter, an exposer, and an embodiment of what I talk about as this kind of elite charade of changing the world. I think a lot of what's gone on that I've tried to tackle is rich people who are part of this predatory elite that has essentially extracted potential from the bottom half of this country, who then rebrand themselves as saviors, philanthropists, changers of the world. And part of how they do that is by convincing people, there's certain moves they make. They convince people that, you know, my interests are the same as yours. They convince people that they're somehow their wealth makes them not corrupt, but actually especially capable of fighting for the underdogs, incorruptible. They make a move of trying to suggest that they and only they can kind of tell the truth. And Donald Trump, kind of in this mad genius way, both called the fraud on elites who claim to be fighting for others. He played that game of these elites don't care about you, they're shipping jobs overseas, they're doing immigration policy to benefit companies, not you. And then, of course, he was the embodiment of the elite con of pretending to care for underdogs. He, to me, is the reductio ad absurdum of a culture that trusts billionaires to save us. And I don't think we can understand him. I think we tend to understand him as a one-off. To me, he's the product of deep tendencies in our culture. Deep tendencies with regard to race and whiteness, but also deep tendencies with regard to our trust, almost our hope in being saved by the super rich.
And speaking of that hope, how disconnected are the super rich from their actual communities? I mean, I think this is a point that you make in your work, that people are no longer connected, say, I become a gazillionaire and I grew up in Lower Manhattan and I want to give back to my local Boys and Girls Club, for example. You're suggesting that that disconnectedness is happening more and more from place, right, where these elites live and or work, perhaps?
I mean, I will tell you, it's such a fascinating thing. I know so many people in America who are doing something to help Kenya, and I know nobody who's doing anything to help Kentucky. And I think there's a reason for that. I just use those places as metaphors. I think we used to have this idea that we were all particularly elites. We're kind of leaders of a community. We're part of a community. And so if you did well in that community, if you think back to your parents' or grandparents' generation, but those people who kind of pulled up fortune from the ground often reinvested it in the ground. We now live in a kind of here, there, everywhere world where the idea of place has almost vanished. I'm sitting here with a coffee cup in front of me. For all I know, that coffee cup was made by a company in Atlanta, but designed by someone in South Korea, and then made by someone in China, and then shipped but coordinated the logistics by a Finnish company. But actually, the company in Atlanta is owned by Dutch private equity investors, which actually invests a Brazilian pension fund.
This is the most interesting cup of coffee in the world.
And everything on our bodies, everything around us, is now made this way. Nothing belongs anywhere. And there's a lot of good that's come out of that. But I think part of it is no one feels responsibility for any place.
Also, you know, bringing it back to the United States, I mean, lots of wealth is generational. You know, when we talk about wealth in this country, when we talk about this myth of the meritocracy, we don't talk about things like the Homestead Act, which essentially gave land away for free, right? And so the wealth that's accumulated through that, the wealth that's accumulated through passing down homes and home ownership and land and redlining, and there's so many other reasons why. You know, the wealth gap data says it'll take more than 200 years to close the gap between blacks and whites in America. So that tension, that stress, you mentioned this earlier when you said there are people in the basement. Are the people in the basement, if you will, planning on coming out of the basement? Are you seeing some sort of class resentment or more class revolt, if you will?
I think we are. And those revolts don't always necessarily take the forms that everyone's going to like. So I think it's hard to look at the election of Trump without saying that even from my point of view, it's one of the most disastrous things that's ever happened to this country. It also reflects somewhere buried in there a correct intuition laced with a lot of other horrible sentiments that elites in this country don't really give a crap about average people. I think that intuition is in there somewhere for many people, and I think it's right. I also don't think we, because of what happened in the election, remember how remarkable it was that Bernie Sanders, not only because he was a socialist, but also because he was like everybody's worst grandpa, came as far as he did to defeating the most powerful, formidable political family in America. You know, I think we are living in a time in which, you know, young people are absolutely exploring the question of, is capitalism even something they believe in? I think we're living in a time in which people are dropping out of, sometimes voluntarily and sometimes not, of kind of conventional work lives, in part because it's hard to get into 9-to-5 jobs these days and have companies kind of bear the risk of making you an employee, but also because a lot of people don't believe that there's any pot of gold at the end of those rainbows.
Lots to unpack there, and I'd love to continue this conversation. I feel like we could talk about this for hours. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, and congrats again on a great debut.
Thanks. Haven't had enough of me yet? Well, on Monday, I'm going to be doing a Facebook Live hit with Brooke Gladstone. You know her, right? The queen of On the Media. And we'll be taking your questions about me. Want to know what I'm all about? Now you have your chance. Follow us on Facebook for more information, including the start time, and we'll see you there. Yesterday, President Trump announced that he is withdrawing, or some would say violating, the Iran nuclear deal.
It is clear to me that we cannot prevent an Iranian nuclear bomb under the decaying and rotten structure of the current agreement.
Aaron David Miller is vice president of the Wilson Center and former Middle East negotiator for the State Department. We spoke with him just before the president officially announced the decision.
I think it's a highly flawed agreement, but it is viable. And it has placed significant constraints and restraints on Iran's capacity to develop enough fissile material to make a nuclear weapon.
And let's also just briefly talk about what the original intent of this deal was.
Well, the intent during the Obama administration, in my view, was to preempt the growing possibility of an Israeli strike in response to an Iranian nuclear program that had the capacity to move very quickly to break out, that is to say, to create enough fissile material to make a nuclear weapon, and at the same time to make an American strike unnecessary. I don't think anybody looked at this as a transformational agreement. It was essentially transactional, Tanzina. It was an arms control agreement designed to restrain and constrain for varying amounts of time Iran's capacity, either through plutonium extraction or uranium enrichment of uranium, to produce a weapon. And according to the IAEA, the International Agency for Atomic Energy, it was actually working. And I think that therein lies the real problem, because without a plan B, it seems to me we're heading into an extremely uncertain situation, which has any number of consequences. In my judgment, none of them are going to be terribly beneficial for the United States.
Now, what about, we're potentially looking at serious implications in the region. What about Iranian citizens, people who are on the ground, who will be directly impacted by sanctions, et cetera?
Well, there, I think you're already seeing, as a consequence of a great deal of uncertainty with respect to investment in the Iranian economy, even though there's been a certain amount of economic improvement, you've got an economy that has so many structural and systemic flaws, in which various groups, the regime supporters, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, has found a way to evade sanctions and are making millions of dollars off of all sorts of illicit arrangements and legitimate arrangements with all kinds of business transactions. That's only going to get worse as the rial plummets, as inflation rises, unemployment's going to increase. And you saw in December something you've never seen before, a fairly large and widespread series of protests among lower middle class Iranians who are fed up with the notion that the regime is enriching itself and paying for foreign adventures instead of investing in their well-being and in their future. I think that it may well be one of the calculations of the administration that tightening the screws economically will lead to cracks within the regime and over time, perhaps, even though I'm not sure this is realistic, uprisings within the country. I think that is the new calculation that this administration is going to make. And withdrawing from the JCPOA is the first step in that new strategy.
Well, let's talk about another calculation, and that this administration has said repeatedly that it basically, essentially wants to undo many of the policies that the previous administration had implemented. Is that behind this? Is this purely a move to sort of, you know, undo the President Obama legacy or the Obama administration legacy? Or is there actual indications that Iran perhaps was not living up to its end of the deal and therefore need to have sanctions implemented?
You know, I work for Republicans and Democrats. I voted for Republicans and Democrats. And most of the administrations I worked for, of course, domestic politics is an important calculation. But never have I seen a preternatural commitment by any administration to preserving its domestic base. And in the case of this particular president, emerging to make it unmistakably clear that he is the un-Obama. Yes, I think that the first effort to undo the Affordable Care Act, which was his predecessor's signal domestic achievement, did not succeed, or perhaps it succeeded in part. Now, this is an effort to undo his signal foreign policy accomplishment, the nuclear deal with Iran. And yes, I think it is driven not primarily by foreign policy considerations. And if you look again, I'll say it again, this is not a partisan comment, voted for R's and D's and worked for them too. But if you look at the pattern of the president's policies, whether it's withdrawal from Paris Climate, whether it's withdrawal from the TPP, whether it's the imposition of travel bans, frankly, that in my judgment are not necessary to preserve the security of the United States and compromise our value in the process, and even the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, all of these are not driven by foreign policy considerations. They are driven by a politically colored America First strategy, as the president defines it. In short, the president seems to have become adept at developing solutions for problems that our quite extraordinary republic doesn't have. And here I think you're going to see another example of that. The JCPOA is flawed. There's no question about it. How it's going to be resolved in the out years when it expires, these provisions expire, is a weakness of the agreement. But it is working. And it is, you can't beat something with nothing. And frankly, walking from this agreement is going to leave us with nothing.
Now, you've painted a pretty stark picture of what could be the future in the region. What about for the United States? I mean, if this escalates, if this really creates an escalation of tensions in the region, is this potentially something that could take us into another conflict that will have American boots on the ground?
I don't think you're talking about significant deployment of American forces. What you're talking about in terms of conflict, if it comes to that, and it's still a big if, is an asymmetrical sort of confrontation in which the Iranians, through their agents and their proxies, try to inflict the maximum damage they can on American forces in Iraq, which they are clearly capable of doing. They did it during the Bush administration while we were there. They are capable of making our lives and our allies' lives miserable, certainly in Syria. You could see an increase in terrorism outside of the Middle East. But if the Iranians go that route, I think you really are talking then about a U.S. response largely through missiles and aircraft, which could lead to U.S. strikes on the Iranian mainland. And if that is what you're talking about, you're talking about disruption of oil supplies. You're talking about a degree of economic dislocation, which is going to affect how many months of recovery with respect to the economy. So it's worst case. Nobody ever lost money betting against worst case in the Middle East. And I suspect the problems are going to get worse before it gets worse with the Iranians. Whether it comes to this sort of catastrophic scenario I'm painting is another matter. I wouldn't want to predict it. But we've embarked now on a very slippery slope.
Aaron David Miller is a vice president of the Wilson Center and former Middle East negotiator for the State Department. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
As President Trump briefly mentioned in his announcement yesterday, there are Americans detained by the Iranian government.
Over the years, Iran and its proxies have bombed American embassies and military installations, murdered hundreds of American service members, and kidnapped, imprisoned, and tortured American citizens.
There are currently 5 Americans and 1 green card holder who are being held in Iran. And when President Trump announced on Tuesday that he was pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, this small group might have the most to lose if the two countries' relationship falls apart. Hale Esfandiari is an Iranian-American who was held in prison in Iran in 2007. She wrote about her experience in the book My Prison, My Home. She's the former director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson Center and is now a fellow there. On the heels of President Trump's announcement, I asked her to reflect on her time in detention.
As I was leaving to come back to the United States, I was stopped on my way to the airport, and they kept me in Iran for 8 months under country arrest, of which I spent 105 days in solitary confinement in Evin prison, where currently the Iranian-Americans who are prisoners in Iran are kept. I mean, they believed I was part of a plot to overthrow the Iranian government. They were very suspicious of the United States' intention then, as they are now.
How did you end up getting released?
Well, there was really an international outcry and the effort of the then head of the Wilson Center, Congressman Lee Hamilton, and my family, who reached out to different people in different countries and asked for their intervention on my behalf.
So there are at least five Americans and one green card holder who are currently in detention in Iran. What can you tell us about them?
Well, of those six, I believe five have been sentenced, a father and son, Baqir and Siamak Namazi, were detained 3 years ago, and they have been each sentenced to 10 years. There is a Chinese-American who was a student, a graduate student at Princeton, who also got 10 years. There is a gallery owner who is an American-Iranian. He got 27 years. And his wife, who has a green card, is a permanent resident in the U.S., got 16 years. And there is an environmentalist who was arrested in January 2018 with a group of other environmentalists, but fortunately, he has not yet been charged.
And I'm wondering what the United States' role is in this. Should we be engaged with Iran about these prisoners, particularly after yesterday's announcement?
Well, until yesterday, the hope was that the United States, either directly or through its friends around the world, could intercede on behalf of these prisoners. But after yesterday's announcement and the United States walking out of the JCPOA, first of all, the prisoners will be very disappointed when they hear the news. And secondly, I don't know how the United States is going to contact the Iranian to talk to them about the plight of these Iranian Americans. And also, I mean, who is going to mediate on behalf of the United States? I mean, who is going, which government is going to go now to the Iranian and plead on behalf of these prisoners when the Americans have walked out of the JCPOA? So that's, for me as a former prisoner, a very big concern.
And can you give us a sense of what the conditions were that you endured? You said solitary confinement, but can you tell us, our listeners, a little bit more about what prisoners are dealing with right now?
Well, if you are in solitary confinement, it means that you are in a cell by yourself, and your interlocutor or your interrogator. In my case, I was interrogated 8 to 9 hours a day, you know, and then sent back to my cell. And then once you are in your cell, even if you want to use the facilities, you have to knock on them on an iron door and they come and open the door and let you out. Whether you have access to 1 hour of fresh air every day or not, it depends on, you know, your status as a prisoner. So, I mean, you are completely cut off from the world and you don't have access even to your lawyers. I mean, they are harsh conditions, to put it mildly.
Is there any hope for their release now that this announcement has been made by the president?
I'm an optimist by nature, but I can't see anything happening in the immediate futures. And I really think that the interrogators will make sure that the Iranian-American prisoners hear the news and they will tell them, look what the American government has done to you. And you know, when you are in prison, you tend to snatch on every glimmer of hope and you keep praying someone will intercede on your behalf. And then when the Iranian-American now in prison in Iran will learn what has happened, they will feel their chances for release has really greatly diminished. I mean, I just don't see any hope in the immediate future. But I mean, on the other hand, I wish and I hope that the U.S. government will use every means, meaning the goodwill of other countries, to get the release of these people who are innocently kept.
Elias Fandari was held as a prisoner in Iran in 2007, and she wrote about that experience in her book, My Prison, My Home. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's all we got for this Wednesday. The Takeaway here, it's been great talking with you. And just so you know, we have this cool new thing on thetakeaway.org. If you're there on your phone, you can record a voice memo and send it to us with your thoughts on anything, literally anything. But also, hopefully, specifically answering some of our questions of the day. And if we hear you in quality and you deliver some quality comments, you will be on this podcast. So go for it. You'll have fun. It's at thetakeaway.org/mytake. More tomorrow and every day. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.